What's up, y'all? It's Zach with Living Corporate. Look, every single day, I wake up and I'm passionate about centering and amplifying Black and Brown folks at work. Right? We go through these seasons where people act like we're so needed and precious, and then we go through these seasons where we're just treated disposably. Right? We've seen that really heightened since 2020, the murder of George Floyd, and we saw all these pledges and stuff. And we saw all this language and commitments from organizations, but now we're seeing a lot of folks renege on all those commitments and pledges, right? We're seeing Black and Brown folks continue to be disparately impacted by massive layoffs in the tech industry. The industry that was promoted as the place for Black and Brown folks to get some equitable treatment and to have some sort of financial security and wealth generation. We're seeing a continual backtracking from the same people that boldly said that Black lives matter. Okay. But the good news is, for me anyway, and for Living Corporate, is we existed before diversity, equity, and inclusion was hyper in vogue. And we're going to continue to exist as diversity becomes a disgusting cuss word. Right. The other good news I'm going to say is that we don't really subscribe to all of that hyper white liberal jargon. That is really what diversity, equity, and inclusion is. It's a bunch of different gobbledygook words that don't really mean much, that really aren't defined well. I'm excited about the fact that we have conversations with executives, activists, elected officials, entrepreneurs, influencers, artists, and every single week, dare I say every single day, we're publishing content that challenges systems, structures, and people to do right by historically marginalized people. And by historically marginalized, I mean Black and Brown queer, Black and Brown trans, Black and Brown disabled, Black and Brown men, Black and Brown women, Black and Brown non-binary, Black and Brown first generation, Black and Brown people, right? The country is going to continue to get blacker and browner. And it's important that our voices continue to be heard. I still believe that the strongest weapon and the biggest gift I have is my voice. And Living Corporate is a megaphone and an amplifier for all things Black and Brown at work. So I'm happy that you're listening. Welcome to the network. We outside, baby. Let's go. Now look, the next thing you're going to hear, we're going to have, you know what I'm saying, our interview. I'm excited for you to check out this interview. Don't go nowhere. I'm going to see you in a minute. Peace. Dr. Abdul Rahman, how are you doing? Welcome to Living Corporate.
I am good. As Toni Morrison said, I am angry, but then I get to work. So that's how I'm doing.
You know, it's interesting. We talk to a lot of authors, right? And professors and, you know, accredited PhD folks like on Living Corporate. We've been doing that for years now, to be honest. You know, your book, Developing an Anti-Racist Cultural Competence. I find the premise itself very intriguing, maybe because of what I'm projecting onto that title. But talk to me about like how you got to, first of all, what triggered the decision to even write a book? And then part B to that, what led to the title Developing Anti-Racist Cultural Competence?
Well, I mean, I remember when I first got into consulting, coaching, and speaking, one of my colleagues is like, Abdurrahman, you're going to have to write a book. And I'm like, I'm not writing a book. I have no time for that. You know, I just was like, I'm not writing a book. But I have been quite explicit and quite direct in a lot of the work that I do. I've developed all sorts of resources. And I believe in telling the truth. I do not believe that we can get far without being able to be honest about the nature of the problem that we face in our world when it comes to equity, diversity, and inclusion. But then one of my colleagues approached me a few years ago, and he's like, I think it's time for you to write your book. And I'd like you to write the book for the series. The series is typically written for clinicians, But I was like, no, I don't want this book to just be for clinicians. The idea here is that we all need to develop these skills. And so that's how the book got, that's how the book was developed. And the book was meant to be addressing cultural competence. But for me, the whole concept of cultural competence is very much a colonialistic kind of idea. And I don't think that we can approach cultural competence unless we do it in an anti-racist way. And that's where that comes from. I think colonial culture has a history of treating people of color and people who come from non-white cultural communities as a cultural zoo. And there is documentation of human zoos. National Geographic is very much, you know, that type of cultural zoo. And as a result of that, we approach people of color and their culture and their world perspectives as an anthropological exercise. You know, as Ellen Cleghorn said, you know, why is it that the famous Saturday Night Live female black comedian, she's like, why is it that, you know, when white women are naked, it's pornography, but black women, when they're naked, it's anthropology. And we really, and so when we approach cultural competence, for me, the dilemma here is that we tend to other people, and it's as if people are walking around in a zoo or they are looking into a fishbowl and they don't recognize that they too swim in the same water as we do, and that the work to become culturally competent is really the work to become anti-racist.
Well, and I'll say this, and like, not to tweak or edit your language at all, it also sounds like there's a work to become more empathetic to the human experience and respectful of like your fellow human being. I mean, the idea of treating people, and to your point, the historical record of having black and brown people in zoos is well documented. You know, I'll ask you this too, you know, especially as we think about this landscape and you being an academic, right? Like, certainly you're aware of like the increased tensions and resistance on matters of anything that has an E, a D, or I, or J, or whatever in it. What are you experiencing in this moment and writing and publishing research so explicitly in this arena that maybe is unique to this season, or maybe it's not unique to this season? I'm curious just to hear, like, what has that been like?
Well, I think that generally speaking, I will say that there's a lot of positivity. I think people do appreciate the honest perspective, but with that honesty will also come people who, excuse me, people who are very angry about it. And, I mean, it's not uncommon that I get hate mail, people who kind of dive deep, learn about who you are, include that in the hate mail, you know, that kind of stuff. Can be a bit unnerving. I'd say in today's political climate, I think, and given my identity, you know, as a person with Arab lineage, as a Muslim, I think the hate just increases. The dilemma here, I think, is with doing the work with diversity, equity, and inclusion is that we can't be selective about what topics we address. You know, none of us are free until all of us are free. And people don't understand that these aren't matters of charity. You know, you mentioned the concept of empathy. Yes. But I think what people don't understand is not addressing diversity, equity, and inclusion in any aspect of space and ignoring really critical elements tied to our human existence and our world experience really actually negatively impacts like people with great privilege as well too. Research that shows that, you know, not addressing inclusion actually artificially increases a sense of self-worth as an ethnicity and as a culture in white people. And so really what we're doing is breeding racism and, you know, creating poor world leaders. And that's critically important in every domain, any work sector. This is not a matter of charity. This is a matter of human development and growth. And that's to me is the critical thing, despite the hate that I might get.
You know, you talk about your own cultural, your own background, and like offline, we were talking about, I was asking you about your ethnicity, and I was like, you know, like, it's not you, are you South Asian? You're like, well, I'm Zanzibarian. I'm like, that's super dope. Like, talk to me about the intersection of, you know, your own lived experience and identity and like anti-racism, right? So like, I think like there's this, and I ask for a variety of reasons. Shoot. First of all, I ask because I'm excited to get your perspective. Second, I ask because I'm personally selfishly curious. You think about like, in this DEI space or IND or whatever acronyms you want to put together. There's a lot of effort to bundle and as a consequence, erase like multiple non-white identities, right? So let's use the word people of color. I think in Europe, they use the term BAM, which is just like, it's basically like everybody who isn't white is just Black, Asian, and Middle Eastern. It's like, that's just, like, it's ridiculous. I think what happens though in that work, in that effort, is it erases like the very real nuances of bigotry, discrimination, racism, sexism, patriarchy, misogyny, etc., homophobia, ableism, the list goes on, that happens within those spaces. So like, when you talk about like cultural competency, like, I'd love just to hear your perspective on like how these things may pivot and look different group to group, like within these non-white or these non-majority spaces.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to take a deep breath. I got a lot to say. First and foremost, I talk about my identity in the book. Like, I think there are times that we approach this issue in a very academic way and, you know, from a distance. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's how we're going to get further. And so I like to practice what I preach, and I use my identity in the book to talk about who I am. Mm-hmm. Now, I did a whole TEDx talk on this called Resolving Unconscious Bias, you know, with the title, but where are you really from? And this is something that's kind of plagued me, right? It's just like, when people, like, I think the concept of race is really a racist ideology where we pigeonhole people into these kind of like, you know, which race are you? But race is a social construct. It's a racist social construct. The moment you step outside the United States and Canada, it kind of falls apart. And there are places in the world where, like, how far back do we want to go to determine our quote unquote race? And so for me as a Zanzibari, like, I remember immigrating to Canada and everybody would say, well, what are you? You know, what are you? What, who are you? And I would say, well, you know, well, where are you from? And being an immigrant at the time, my identity wasn't necessarily immediately tied to Canada. It was more tied to Tanzania. And I'd say, I'm Tanzanian. And they'd say, yeah, but that's in Africa. And I said, yes. And they said, but you're not black. And, you know, I'd take a look at my skin. I was like, well, I know that. You know, and so we have these stereotypical ideas of who belongs in certain places. Mm. And people don't understand that the world is actually a very mixed place. So, you know, my grandmother is Indian, but her maternal line goes into Northern Europe. You know, we've got strong lineage in Arab blood, which would be in Oman. My great-grandfather is Turkish. You know, we found out through some lineage testing that we had some East Asian blood. So, like, where are we going with this? Do you know, like, how far back? And for me, ethnicity is really very cultural. You know, it's not just about how we present, because I think at some point in time, any of us done the 23andMe genetic test, we find the question who we are is really our culture.
Right.
And that becomes very clear to me when I go back to visit. Like, I did a lot of teaching in Tanzania and Zanzibar. And a lot of people see me as a foreigner. In fact, when I'm there, it's not uncommon that people will engage with me and they call me Mzungu, which in Swahili means white man. And now, not because of my presentation phenotypically, because there are white people that are clear, but because of how I present, that my culture represents where I grew up, which was Canada, how I talk, how I engage, what are my mannerisms. And it actually takes some convincing for people. You know, when I do the work, people are really held back. And then, you know, my colleagues there would be like, you know, you can just be honest with him. He's from here. And they'd be like, oh, and they're like, do you know Haji Omar so-and-so? you know, he had like a Turkish delight shop, like a lokum shop, like down on this street. And they're like, yes. And they're like, this is his grandson. And they're like, oh, and it's interesting that it's culture that connects us. Mm-hmm. It isn't necessarily our ethnicity. When people of color experience racism and we engage with other people of color who've experienced racism, the thing that connects us, that makes us feel like kin, is our experience. It is our culture that we connect through. And sadly, racism and discrimination becomes an inherent part of cultural identity, which I talk about in the book, because we can't remove it from our experience. And so if we approach our world through our culture, more so than, you know, a racist concept of race, and our ethnicity that breaks down who we really are as people, that contributes to our cultural point of view and our worldview, I think that's far more meaningful.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting too. Like I find it intriguing, and I agree with what you're saying. I think, you know, it's interesting. I've had conversations now for years, both on Living Corporate and away from Living Corporate, about like the phenomena of anti-blackness around the world. And it would seem as if part of like, you know, the assimilating into like the American experience, assimilating is a broad term, because I don't mean to say that when you come, like when immigrants matriculate to America, that they put away their identity. I mean, I think it's a beautiful thing when I go and I see like little, quote unquote, little China and other spaces. Houston's a phenomenal example of this. You can get some of the best Indian food outside of New York, I'm gonna say, right? But the point is though that like I've been having these discussions around the idea that like part of the American experience and coming to America, and perhaps like just the Western world, I don't know. I'm not going to speak to the West in this moment. I'm going to just speak to America because I live here, is also taking on some anti-Black sentiments as well, right? That like it's so embedded in like the American culture that Black folks are typically at the bottom of the totem pole, that when you come in, like, it's part of that as well. Like when you think about this, the racial hierarchy or pecking order, as it were, I'm curious, like, have you heard similar sentiments considering like your extremely global profile and like your background? Like, you know, where does the concept of anti-Blackness come into this larger framework of anti-racist, yeah, pretext and demand?
Well, I think it's critically important. Like, I think sometimes this is where I think the concept of racism is racist, right? Like, I think when we think about Blackness, we think about one group of people, one perspective, and that's not how it works, right? Like, so in, for example, the Arab and Muslim community, Blackness is tied into that. Now, it doesn't mean we don't have colorism, and it doesn't mean there wasn't anti-Black racism, because it existed. You know, the honest truth has existed, you know, even at the advent of Islam, and Islam actually worked to remove anti-Black racism. Mm. But that said, despite that, our identities link together, not based on how our phenotype is, but on our culture. So like when I meet another Muslim, or if I'm in Tanzania and Zanzibar, our connection has nothing to do with our appearance, because over time, those bloodlines mixed, you know? And I mean, we got family that's Black. Mm-hmm. You know, my son is part Black, you know, because his mother had that mixture, you know? So the question is, where does one end and the other begin? And I think we in North America and the Western world really aim to start dividing. And anytime you speak with people who come from a mixed race background or a mixed ethnic background, they'll talk to you about the frustrations.
Yes.
You know, and coming up with their identity. So for me, anti-Black racism, yes, it is a thing globally. There is no doubt about it. But I do appreciate it. Like when we address the concept from a cultural landscape, because once we address it from a cultural landscape, we have greater like overlapping, intersecting identities.
Yeah.
My ability to connect with my Black colleagues is based on our common experience, you know?
Yeah.
Me connecting with my Indigenous colleagues is based on our intersecting identities.
Yeah.
But this concept is not new. Like, it, you know, we talked about the concept of cultural competence being a colonial white kind of thing. That's not how we approach it in other parts of the world.
Yeah.
Like, this is not how we do that. You know, there's actually some influencers who talk about, you know, where are the safest places to travel as a Black person. And often when they go to many countries of an Arab or a Muslim background, it's like a non-issue, you know. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is because Blackness is tied into that culture. Mm-hmm. And like if you, you know, so for example, when you go to Sudan, you know, a lot of the times your culture is not tied to your phenotype or your perceived ethnicity, but your language. Do you know? So if you go to Zanzibar, like most people there will consider themselves Arab. And so as much as, you know, like because our culture is very Arab, so we can have mixed backgrounds. And people, I remember there was a Black American documentary maker who'd gone to Zanzibar, and he found it very strange. And he saw it as a sign of ignoring your heritage. He said, all these Black people are talking about how they're Arab. I feel like they're not comfortable with their identity. And that's not how it works. The concept here is identity in many places of the world is not based on our phenotype, but our culture.
Yeah.
And so when, yeah, sorry, I'm going on and on.
No. First of all, you're the guest. You can't go on and on. That resonates with me, right? I think it's hard for us being those in the West, though I'm predominantly Americans, to imagine and consider looking at somebody and not differentiating yourself or assuming and tying a culture to an aesthetic, right?
Yeah.
Like that's a different context. I also believe it's part of like our American cultural snobbery, or perhaps to the point of your book, incompetence, that we can't really like disassociate or decouple that. But it's interesting, right? I remember when I went to the Black History Museum in DC. And for those who are listening and like don't know, like when you start in that museum, you start at the basement, right? And so then like you see, I think it goes back to like the pre-1500s, 1400s, 1300s. But they were talking about how like, hey, like back then there wasn't Black, there wasn't white. And of course we see all these people saying like race is a social construct, which it is. But sometimes people say that and they say it to dismiss the reality of racism, which that's a separate podcast for another day. But the point is that like they were describing what you're articulating here, which is it wasn't phenotype based. It was about like where you're from, like your language. Mm-hmm. And like,
yes.
And what you do, yes. And like where your people are from, and like what they do, it was like very much so like it was very much so like geography. It wasn't like, oh, your eyes are smaller, or your nose is bigger, or your skin is darker, or your hair is kinkier. It was about, hey, no, we're all from this particular land and this tribe or this group.
Correct.
So like let's talk a little bit about like I love the idea of and to your point about like divisiveness, I love the idea of embracing culture, understanding and sharing experience. That is a much more unifying avenue from my vantage point, Dr. Abdul Rahman, in that you can build from that. Like we can have a conversation about shared experience, about shared background, about like travel and things of that nature. And that isn't to erase the things that are about you that are unique, but it's tough if I'm gonna have a conversation and all I look at you and I see, and I just presume you're Arab, right?
Or Asian
or whatever.
Some kind of brown.
Yeah. And it's like we're operating from the premise of difference and dissonance. Then how do we like really build there? I mean, I'm curious, right? Like, you're also like, you sit in this, like, in this academic space. Like, where and how do you believe that, like, organizational culture is like, and let me also back up and say, I'm not ignorant to the reality that, like, academia is becoming more corporate, especially, like the non-faculty, but like those staff teams and orgs are becoming increasingly more corporatized in their format and structure. Frankly, kind of everything is, which I really think is tied to like this larger, like late stage capitalist society that we're entering into. Everything is like production and everything. There's a pressure to like just speed up and get everything done very quickly. But the point is, you exist in this world, like the research and the work that you, the writing you do. Where do you believe organizations, like for-profit organizations, can apply cultural competence?
Yes.
To their day to day. Like, what does that look like in your mind?
Yeah, I want to take it one step back and talk a little bit about relating to culture, because I think it ties into this next question.
Sure.
So I feel very at home in African culture because it is my culture, right? Like, if I see Black people, I feel at home. Mm-hmm. Now, that's an odd thing for people to think of when they look at my face, but they don't understand who I am and where I've come from and who I consider home and who I consider family. And so it's important to understand that perspective. And so when we think about who we see as local and who we see as belonging to our community, that is critically important for corporations to pay attention to. Hmm. What we know from the data, so I collected this broad base of data based on a tool I developed called the Bias Outside the Box tool, mm-hmm. or testbias.com. And it gives us a sense of how people see those who are different from them, including people of color. What we have found overwhelmingly is that people of color are seen as foreign and white people are seen as local. Mm-hmm. That's a critically important fact for any corporation to pay attention to, because they understand now not only how their teams work, but also the market base that they may have. And the moment you have that bias that certain people are outsiders, not only have you reduced kind of engagement from your staff, which we know is true. We know from data that people of color often feel less engaged in corporate cultures because they don't feel represented, because it's typically white culture, because they don't feel like they have equal say, and because they have to code switch often to be able to get along in a corporate world. So we know that. Now, can you imagine if a corporate leader was aware of this and shifted culture to make it more inclusive? Incredible. Now take the concept of the market base. Mm. We know, generally speaking, when it comes to behavioral economics, you catch more flies with sugar than with vinegar. You want a bigger market base? Make sure that people feel included. It is true that you can make people buy stuff by making feel that they're not good enough. This is true. But you can get, we know from simple behavioral kind of implementation of how human beings work and behavioral economics, that we get further by having greater representation, right? People feeling included. So where this comes into corporate culture and I think business is that I think organizations and leaders need to have that awareness and that insight. They need to have that proximity. And the moment you have that proximity, you begin to understand culture and you begin to think like other people do. And to me, this is where anti-racist cultural competence is critical to every sector of work, including the corporate world. Because the moment you move past, because the truth is there is a barrier. There's a very clear barrier between people of color and white people, guaranteed. Far less of a barrier between people of color, because people of color have already figured out that we have common experiences. And we know that because when we're sitting around the boardroom and somebody says some microaggression or something racist, we look at each other and raise our eyebrows. You know, we've already figured that out. It is now time for white people and white leaders to begin to come into the fold. But that requires a great sense of humility. That requires the ability to understand that they've engaged in some wrongs. And that requires a great process of coaching and learning to be able to have that proximity, to have cultural proximity and understanding, to be able to, as I say, get the inside joke. If you can get the inside joke, you have now unlocked the ability to engage your team and increase your market base.
You know, and I agree with all of that. I think here's my challenge. We're in 2024 where everything related to this work is seen as Marxist and communist and anti-American and divisive. And sometimes some would even claim, I call it anti-Semitic. So, and so for me, it's like my, not even pushback, like my thought is just like, okay, how do we expect white people who already, especially who are in like, in, you know, it's in the corporate context, who already do by the numbers control an overwhelming amount of the market and control an overwhelming amount of these companies end to end to quote unquote, to your language, humble themselves and seek coaching when like, what is the incentive? Like, what is the immediate incentive, right? We talked a bit earlier about just where we are economically. People don't operate like, this is not Japan, right? Or like somewhere in the East where people are looking like at multiple quarters and looking at like long-term growth and trends. People are looking month to month, at best quarter to quarter. So like, where do you expect people to adopt an attitude that would even agree and find the value in doing that? And this is not me poo-pooing. The book is fire.
No, no.
I want to understand your perspective though.
You are 100% on point and very, very true. But I think this is white fragility to its max. You know, is that the moment you have people of color descent to a point of view, you label them and you, I mean, I've got a new term in the book that I talk about. I call it a psychological checkpoint. Hmm. That in order to be granted the privilege, any validity for your point of view, you must surpass an agreement that you disagree, or you agree with white people that some people of color are threatened. You know, there's a common phrase that goes around now, you know, the moment you start to advocate for a particular group of people that come from my community. But what about this? And the moment you say those kinds of words, that is a psychological checkpoint. So, yes, I agree that there is great sense of fragility where we deflect blame. Now, I'm going to take it one step further. To me, racism is ultimately a form of group narcissism. What we know and understand about narcissism is many times people don't understand it. You know, they don't understand that they carry that, but it places them at the top of everything. And the moment that that is threatened, they attack, they deflect, and they split groups of people. And so it's not uncommon that we see many times where white leadership will split people of color to fight against each other. And I often talk about when there is such little inclusion, there's only a few crumbs left. The hungry will fight over those crumbs. So yes, full and truth, this does exist. To me, this is where it comes back to a cultural shift. And I think many corporations really need to be thanking dissenting movements because they're the ones that shift culture, that make it more inclusive. Ironically, many companies will fight that change. Like, for example, you know, we've been advocating for the Black Lives Matter movement for a very long period of time prior to George Floyd. But after George Floyd, you know, it was that movement that pushed many companies into, I don't want to speak on their intent or their authenticity, but to now include Black people in commercials and have greater representation. So, you know, they went along with it kicking and screaming, but it took a great degree of that movement of dissent to be able to get to that point. So regardless of their sincerity, that movement actually broadened their market. And so how do we make people do that? There's two ways. Number one, I do think that we need kind of activism. And whether white people realize it or not, whether white people who are racist realize it or not, the activist movement is beneficial for society as a whole, including for business. People don't get that. Now, the second piece is, this is where strong leadership is needed. And anytime I work with a leader, anytime I work with an organization, I say to them, you need to be able to take certain steps to be the first person to do things, to be able to shift culture so that who are typically seen as foreign are now seen as local. And if you can do that and you can advertise that you're doing it and you can articulate the reason why you're doing that, you become a leader in the space.
You know,
and that puts you ahead in terms of retainment and in terms of business.
But you know, like, I'm going to say this, it's really rare for organizations to want to be the first mover, right? It's so much monkey see, monkey do behavior here between these really senior executives. Everyone is scared to lead in anything, and certainly anything that it pertains to, anything that would be seen as a third rail, right? But you're absolutely right. I mean, I'm not gonna say the name, but I remember I was speaking to a CDO. This was years ago, and they're pretty incompetent. But I was talking to them about, like, hey, every time we want to say something or put a statement out or do something, why do we have to look at what other people are doing? Like, why don't we just look at what our core values are, what our strategy is, and then let's make decisions based against that, not against what the competitors are doing, those at the top of the hill. Like, if all you're going to do is do what everybody else is doing, you might as well not do anything at all. Like, just don't do it. I agree with you, though, that, like, and it's funny because we're having this conversation right now, and I know there are people who are listening and rolling their eyes and going, oh, that's unrealistic. But the reality is, every year, there's like those handful of companies that actually decide to be the first mover, and they end up winning in the market.
Yes.
Right?
150. Yeah. Let's talk about why it is realistic. One of my biggest complaints is that the moment we move towards activism that affects the minority of white people, we move faster. Anytime it involves people of color, we're far slower. We just know this. But we have done this already, right? We have made quick, drastic movements that actually impact the benefit of all society. We've done this in the past. We've done it with COVID. You see, anytime we recognize there is a huge impact that does impact white people, we move fast. Mm-hmm. And when we do that, there are times where we need to shift and make action prior to getting consent from the general public. And we've done that with COVID. And you know what happened? Everybody went along with it. Mm-hmm. There was good public health knowledge. We understood why we were doing it. There was good information that went along with it. And I think that's a critical part. I think there's a huge psychology to being able to make this change, which is why I do believe organizations and companies do need consulting psychologists along the way to help them understand and navigate and translate the movements that they're making. But when we did this for COVID, we moved. Were there people that were unhappy? Absolutely. But here's the interesting thing. You know, the people who are often complaining about, you know, the social distancing and the mask. Did you notice that the same people were eventually protesting out there with masks? Mm-hmm. You know, it is possible. It is not unrealistic. We have done it. The dilemma here is that the moment it influences people of color, people get scared. And now I'm going to come to the defense of white people. Live in a culture where being called out on bias and racism is a very threatening thing. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, what I talk about in my book is that we need to move towards a culture where we understand the process of becoming inclusive is going to be a challenging process. And we need to create a culture by which we people are asking to know versus asking to tell. And if we create that kind of a culture where people who don't understand are going to say offensive things, but they're asking to learn, you know, most of us people of color, individually, one-on-one, we can tell the difference between asking to know and asking to tell. And when people are asking to know, people are very gracious. Sure, you want me to tell you? I'll tell you, mm-hmm. You know. And again, I talk about one of these experiences in my TEDx talk where this woman, I was sitting on a plane on a way to a meeting in DC, and this woman who was a leader, you know, interrupts me to ask me what I am. I was really irritated, you know, and I didn't have to have the professionality. So I was just like, ma'am, like, I was like, that's very offensive. And I turned around and continued to watch my Star Trek. Mm-hmm. But then she came back and she accepted the fault. And she's like, look, I know I offended you. Can you please tell me so I don't do this again? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, you know, my huffiness, my frustration, my anger, all of that toned down. And I was happy to explain to her. Mm-hmm. And so I think if we moved, it is very frightening and threatening for many white people. I get that. And I'm not looking to change the KKK. I'm not looking to change the hardened white supremacists.
Yes.
The change, the people we need to work on are the people who just don't understand. There is a sense of ignorance. And there's a lot of good, well-meaning people who are looking to make change. And that's where our greatest leverage is to move towards equity, inclusion, and justice.
Listen, the book is called Developing Anti-Racist Cultural Competence by Dr. Raymond Abdulrahman. Hey, you're always welcome on the show. We need to do a probably like a part two and three, because I do want to talk about how we get past like the fluffy, touchy-feely element of some of this space and this work and tie it and get it into like actionable things that drive organizational transformation for the benefit of employees and the customers that those employees serve, right? Like I think about the space, like when I think about the future of this work, I think about that through line being crystallized. Yeah. That's the real way that this work is going to be, in my opinion, sustainable, right? Like we see these dips, these ebbs and flows. Like right now we're seeing massive layoffs of DEI teams. We're seeing massive headcount reductions, even for HR people, right? I mean, even like as this work perhaps is outsourced and exists like an EAP in employee assistance programs, but like there needs to be a different model, in my opinion, of how this work is structured so that it is more easily and obviously attachable to like these like capitalistic enterprises. And perhaps, you know, I mean, we had, I'll say this, like not to name drop too crazy, but we had W. Kamau Bell on and I said, look, is this work even really compatible with capitalism at all? And he was like, no, right? But I'm gonna sell this book though. And he was still selling that book. So like, I want us to continue these conversations. This work has to continue. The idea of culture being its own concept, segmented from and or not necessarily always married to phenotype is huge. I think that's a largely non-Western way of thinking and doing and operating. But look, before I let you go, where can people buy the book? Released, like plug all that.
Yeah. The book, you can purchase it right from the Hagrefa website. There's a link if you want, I can share that with you.
We'll put it in the show notes too.
Yeah. And there's a link for Amazon.com as well too. It's up on Amazon now. Mm-hmm. It'll be released in a couple of weeks. It's gone to press. It'll be out in a couple of weeks. So you can purchase it there. I will give you one answer for people listening. How do they begin this work? For all leaders in this, for any corporate leader, I think the work begins by first having the conversation with yourself. As Freud said, insight is the cure. And I understand the threat and the fear of being able to test bias publicly. And that's why I developed testbias.com. It's for people to have the conversation with themselves. That begins the step to understand what it is you need to do. And then there is the last chapter in my book, Beyond the Therapy Room or Beyond Any Working Relationship. We cannot rely on work to inform and educate us on equity and inclusion and justice. This work is self-development work and needs to begin outside of work, outside any transactional business room, any therapy room. And there's a whole list of suggestions that I make in that last chapter that I encourage people to read.
Man, you dropped a bar on the way out the door. Dr. Abdulrahman, it's a pleasure. We look forward to having you back soon. Till next time, man. Peace.
Pleasure to meet you.
And we're back. Yo, thank you so much for rocking with us at Living Corporate. So excited. Make sure that you check out the links in the show notes to learn more about Living Corporate. If ain't nobody else tell you today, I'm going to tell you right now, I love you. You matter. Take care of yourself. Later.
Living Corporate is a podcast by Living Corporate LLC. Our logo was designed by David Dawkins. Our theme music was produced by Ken Brown. Additional music production by Antoine Franklin for Musical Elevation. Post-production is handled by Jeremy Jackson. Got a topic suggestion? Email us at livingcorporatepodcast@gmail.com. You can find us online on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and living-corporate.com. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.